Welcome to the online course on the Nibbana Sermons 23 to 33 by Bhikkhu Katakurunda Nyanananda, an online course hosted by the Numata Center for Buddhist Studies at the University of Hamburg in collaboration with the Barron Center for Buddhist Studies in Massachusetts. And today we will be looking at sermon number 23. And just from the discussion related to Sermon 22, there were two comments by participants that I wanted to quote. Happy Kren. She says, "Thank you for pointing out that the Brahmajala Sutta is about the arising of hues because of contact and feeling, and not so much about the Buddha refuting all those 62 hues as wrong hues." Yeah, for myself, that was actually quite an important understanding. And I keep hearing again and again this really not appropriate idea about the Brahmajala Sutta, that it's sort of refuting 62 views. And in reality, it is a psychoanalysis of views. In fact, it doesn't even use the word ditti. It uses a vattu, the ground or... Yeah, the ground is probably a good word that led to the rising of the views. And if you look at the first few views, they're the same. They're the same eternalist views, just with different time periods. So it's very beautiful to bring the Brahmajala Sutta into this perspective, and it also helps to relate the Brahmajala to this whole issue of ditti and views that is so prominent in the Atharvaveda. And Robert Crush, he says, "The simile of the kids playing with sandcastles came to my mind. It is such a beautiful and apt simile to our daily lives. Here I think it is not only attachment to specific objects, here the sandcastles, that drives our actions. Often it is a complex network of attachment to objects and social dynamics, which are due to attachment to social relations and social interactions." I thought that was just a very beautiful way of bringing this castle into our daily life. This castle simile. Yeah, and with this, we are already ready to dive into sermon number 23. And this being a university course, I should always give some additional reading. And so the reading I have for lecture 23 is this article in the scene, just the scene, Mindfulness and the Construction of Experience, something I published only very recently in the Mindfulness Journal, an attempt to bring together early Buddhist ideas on how we construct our own experience with relevant research from cognitive psychology. And in this Sermon 23, the Venerable goes into this idea of the construction of the world, which is something I personally find very fascinating. And so I thought that this would be a relevant additional reading for those of you who have the time and interest to go a little bit deeper into one or the other topic that comes up in the sermon. Good, with this now ready for the Venerable Nyanananda. Itang santang itang panitang yadidang sabba sankara samato sabbu paripati nissaggo tanhakankayo virago nirodho nibbana. This is peaceful, this is excellent, namely the stilling of all preparations, the relinquishment of all assets, the destruction of craving, detachment, cessation, extinction. With the permission of the Most Venerable Great Preceptor and the assembly of the Venerable Meditative Monks, this is the 23rd sermon in the series of sermons on Nibbana. The other day we brought up quotations to prove that Nibbana, as the cessation of becoming, carries no implications of a nihilist or annihilationist view, because the Tathagata has transcended the concept of a being. it became evident from those quotations that to assert with an eternalist bias the proposition that the Tathagata exists after death, simply because he is referred to as a being or a person in the discourses, is contrary to the spirit of the Dhamma. The fact that the Arahant, who has done away with the latencies to conceits of I and mine, still continues to use even the words I and mine only as a concession to worldly conventions and common parlance, came to light from the Arahanta Sutta of the Samyutta Nikaya, quoted on an earlier occasion. To remind ourselves of the relevant section of that quotation, we may hark back to the following line. Aham vadami iti pisuvadeya, mamam vadanti iti pisuvadeya, loke samanyam kusalo viditma vuharamantena subuhareya. He might still say, I speak. He might also say, and they speak to me. Being skillful in knowing the worldly parlance, he uses such terms merely as a convention. Comment, translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. If a bhikkhu is an arahan, consummate, with taints destroyed, one who bears his final body, he might still say, I speak, and he might say, they speak to me. Skillful, knowing the world's parlance, he uses such terms as mere expressions. End of comment. The philosophy of voidness that emerges from those discourses which declare that in reality there is no Tathagata, we compare it to the blazing flames arising from the fistfuls of a highly inflammable incense powder at the end of an all-night's ceremony of devil dancing. Generally, this fire ordeal is horrifying to the onlookers. The Buddha also had to stage a similar fire ordeal in the Dhamma Yaga, or the Dhamma sacrifice. He administered to exorcise the malignant personality view, Sakkaya Ditti, ingrained in the minds of worldlings. Of course, there is no explicit reference to such a fire ordeal in the discourses. Comment. Yeah, I think this might be interesting to just give a little background to what I assume stands behind the discussion that follows. I believe in the first series of 11 sermons at one point I already mentioned how normally this discussion would take place at Nisaravanaya after the Venerable had given his talk. In the traditional setting, Sri Lanka, in Asia in general, the kind of open voicing of criticism and that we are so used to in the West, particularly in the academic setting, is not really the way things are done. So what would usually happen is like the Venerable gives his talk and everybody listens, and afterwards they would be discussing among each other. And some were very inspired, and others were more skeptic because, as you would all have noticed, the Venerable often puts into question views, particularly from the commentary tradition, that have been quite firmly upheld in the Theravada tradition. And so those more skeptic would then make some comment, and somebody would then go to see the Venerable Nyanananda, maybe shortly before the next sermon, says, Bhante, you know, some people were saying this, that. It is good if you can say something. And so I assume that somebody may have said, but what is this bringing in the devil dancing? It's not Dhamma, and why is he bringing that in? And so that the Venerable now is taking it, kind of weaving it into his presentation to explain, yes, of course, it's not in the discourse, but these are the reasons why I use this type of simile. That was just as a way of a little bit of background for us to appreciate why sometimes he moves into certain topics. And needless to say, of course, I'm just guessing. I don't know for sure. I wasn't there. End of comment. However, we do come across a word somewhat suggestive of this kind of exorcism. The word vidrupeti, derived from the word dupa, incense, is suggestive of fumigating or smoking out. For instance, we find the following verse in the Bodhi Bhagavad Udana, with reference to the stages of reflection on the law of dependent arising in direct and reverse order that the Buddha had gone through just after his enlightenment. Yadāhave pātu bhavanti dhamma ātāpino jhāyato brahmanasa vidūpayaṁ kittati mārasenaṁ suryova ubhāsayaṁ antalikukhaṁ. When dhammas manifest themselves to the resolutely meditating Brahmin, he stands fumigating the horrors of Mara, like the sun irradiating the firmament. Comment, translation by Ireland. When the truth become manifest to the ardent meditating Brahmin, scattering Mara's host, he stands as does the sun illuminating the sky. End of comment. The dispelling of the hordes of Mara is rather suggestive of a smoking out. In some other discourses, this verb vidupeti is found contrasted with sandupeti. The meaning of both these verbs, which have the dupa element in common, is not quite clear. It is likely that the two words imply two functions of the ritual associated with incense. While some fragrant kind of incense are used for propitiating benevolent spirits, certain caustic types are utilized for exorcising evil spirits. For instance, in the Kajjaniya Sutta of the Samyutta Nikaya, with reference to the noble disciple, the phrase vidupeti na sandupeti occurs. Since the implicit reference is again to the hordes of Mara, the phrase could be rendered as he exorcises and does not propitiate. The ordinary worldling's mode of recognition of the Tathagata is comparable to the recognition of a vortex that has already ceased, with the help of the flotsam and jetsam lightly floating around it. Even after the vortex has ceased, flotsam and jetsam could still go on rotating, giving the wrong impression that the vortex is still there. If one understands that the vortex has actually ceased deep down at its center, then that what remains there now is the great ocean, undifferentiated and unique, one can get rid of the unfounded fear arising from the statement that there is no Tathagata in truth and fact. The cessation of the puni center of the whirlpool is equivalent to inheriting an expansive great ocean. It is where a vortex ceases that the great ocean prevails, unhindered. To give up the limitations of a vortex is to inherit the limitless ocean. The irony arising from these statements is already implicit in the term arahant. We use this term with reference to the Buddha as well as the arahants. Though the commentators later attributed various other meanings to the term, the basic sense is to be worthy of gifts. In fact, it is being worthy of receiving everything. It is by giving up all that one becomes worthy of all. Here too we have a paradox. To become an arahant is to let go of everything. Craving has to be fully abandoned. It is when all desires are gone, when everything is given up, that one becomes worthy of receiving everything. This is the deeper side of the significance of the term arahant. There are six modes of measuring in accordance with the conceit M, asmimana. What is known as alayatana, or the six sense bases, comprise the six scales of measurement asserting the conceit M. At whatever point of time the measuring, evaluating, and assessing done by the six sense bases, such as the eye, ear, nose, etc., ceases, the person concerned thereby becomes immeasurable, invaluable, and boundless. It is here that the simile of the vortex and the ocean becomes meaningful. So the only way of becoming immeasurable and boundless is to abandon all those scales of measurement. This might sound extremely strange. With the cessation of a vortex, the attention of one who has been looking at it turns towards the depth, immeasurability, and boundlessness of the great ocean. This line of reflection might even enable one to get a glimpse of an unworldly beauty in this philosophy of the void, which drives an unfounded fear into the minds of the worldlings. We do get positive proof of this fact in such sections of the Dhammapada as those entitled The Flowers, The Worthy, The Buddha, and The Brahmin, as well as in a number of discourses in the Sutta Nipata, where we come across marvelously scintillating verses. This is understandable, since the dawn of that wisdom which sees the voidness of a self and of everything belonging to a self, and the attainment of the fruits of the path in the light of that wisdom, marks the effulgence as well as the fruition of the samsaric existence of a being. The idea comes up, for instance, in the section on flowers in the Dhammapada. Yatha sankhara dhanasmin unjitasmin mahapate paramang tatanta jayeta suchigandhang manuramam evam sankhara bhutesu andha bhute putunjane atirochati panyaya samma sambuddha savakam. As on top of a rubbish heap dumped by the highway side, there blossoms forth the lotus, pure in fragrance and charming. So amidst the worldlings blind, the fully awakened one's disciple outshines them in marked contrast, in point of wisdom bright. Comment translation by Norman. Just as on a heap of rubbish thrown on the high road, a lotus might grow, with sweet smell delighting the mind. Similarly, among common people who are blind and like rubbish, the disciple of the fully awakened one shines forth by reason of his wisdom. End of comment. So then the Arahant is that charming lotus, arising out of the cesspool of samsara. Surely there cannot be anything frightful about it. There's nothing to get scared about this prospect. In our last sermon, we quoted from a discourse that gives some new definitions and new concepts of the world. We brought up two statements from the Loka Kama Guna Sutta, number 1, of the Salayatana Vagga in the Samyutta Nikaya. The first statement is somewhat riddle-like. There the Buddha addresses the monks and declares, Nahang bhikkave gamanena lokasa antang nyattayang dattayang pattayanti vadami. Na chapanahang bhikkave appatva lokasa antang dukkasa antakiriyam vadami. Monks, I do not say that by traveling one can come to know or see or reach the end of the world. Nor do I say that without reaching the end of the world one can put an end to suffering. Comment translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. Because I say that the end of the world cannot be known, seen or reached by traveling. Yet, Bhikkhus, I also say that without reaching the end of the world there is no making an end to suffering. And here my translation of the Samyukta Agama parallel. I do not say that the person reaches the end of the world by walking, and I also do not say that without walking one reaches the end of the world and the unsurpassed transcendence of dukkha. End of comment. We also mentioned the other day the explanation given by Venerable Ananda to this cryptic statement at the request of those monks who approached him to get it clarified. That explanation embodies the definition given by the Buddha to the term world. It is not the common concept of the world. Yena kuavusu lokasming lokasanyi hodi lokamani ayam buddhanchati ariyasya vinayen loko. Kena chavusu lokasming lokasanyi lokamani chakkuna kuavusu lokasming lokasanyi hodi lokamani Sotena, ghanena, jivaya, kayena, manena koavu so lokasmi lokasanyi hoti lokamani. Yena koavu so lokasmi lokasanyi hoti lokamani. Ayam vuchati aryasa vinaye lukum. Friend, that by which one has a perception of the world, then has a conceit of the world, that in this discipline of the noble ones is called the world. By what friends has one a perception of the world and a conceit of the world? By the eye friends, one has a perception of the world and a conceit of the world. By the ear, by the nose, by the tongue, by the body, by the mind, that French by which one has a conception, perception of the world and a conceit of the world, that in this discipline of the noble ones is called the world. Common translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. That in the world by which one is a perceiver of the world, a conceiver of the world, this is called the world in the noble one's discipline. And what, friends, is that in the world by which one is a perceiver of the world, a conceiver of the world? The eye is that in the world by which one is a perceiver of the world, a conceiver of the world. The ear, the nose, the tongue, the body, the mind is that in the world by which one is a perceiver of the world, a conceiver of the world. That in the world by which one is a perceiver of the world, a conceiver of the world, this is called the world in the noble one's discipline. What in the Chinese parallel, my translation? Whatever there is of a world, a naming a world, of experiencing a world, of designating a world, of a linguistic expression of a world, it all enters into being reckoned as a world. Venerable friends, that is, the eye is a world, a naming of a world, an experiencing of a world, a designation of a world, a linguistic expression of a world. It all enters into being reckoned a world. The ear, the nose, the tongue, the body, the mind is also like that. A learned, noble disciple understands, as it really is, the arising of the six sense spheres, their cessation, their gratification, their danger, and the escape from them. This is called a noble disciple who reaches the end of the world, who understands the world and who, having been burdened by the world, has transcended the world. And after this, Venerable Ananda offers a verse, a poetic summary of this teaching. End of comment. That with which the world is measured, that itself is called the world. The above mentioned measuring rods, namely the eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body and the mind, give us a conceit of the world and a perception of the world. Apart from these six, there is no way of knowing a world. All theories about the world are founded on these six sense bases. By way of a simple illustration, we alluded to the fact that in the absence of any standard measuring rod, we resort to the primordial scales based on this physical frame of ours, such as the inch, the span, the foot, and the fathom. The subtlest scale of measurement, however, is that based on the mind. It is in this mode of measuring and reckoning that concepts and designations play their part. But the Buddha's philosophy of the void goes against all these mental modes. His exorcism by the vision of the void fumigates all concepts and designations. The six sense bases are therefore so many scales of measurement. It is with the help of these that the world is measured. So the above definition of the world brings out the prepared, sankata, nature of the world. It is a thought construct. This does not amount to a negation of the role of materiality. All we mean to say is that the concept of the world is actually an outcome of these six sense bases. To that extent, it is something prepared, a thought construct. While discussing the 10 indeterminate points on a previous occasion, we happened to mention that the first four among them concern the world. The world is eternal. The world is not eternal, the world is finite, and the world is infinite. What those theorists mean by the term world in this context is none other than that prepared world which is constructed by the six sense bases. That is to say, it is just the concept of the world. However, they were not aware of the fact that their concept of the world is a thought construct, because they had no insight into the law of dependent arising. They did not understand that these are mere preparations. The fallacy involved here, that is, the inability to understand that their concept of the world is the outcome of wrong attention, we illustrate it by the simile of the magic kettle. In an exhibition, a magic kettle is displayed from which water keeps on flowing into a basin. One curious onlooker is waiting to see the kettle empty, while the other is waiting to see the basin overflowing. Both are unaware of the fact that a hidden tube conveys the water back again to the kettle, unseen through the same flow of water. The ordinary concept of the world carries with it the same fallacy. The world links under the sway of defilements which thrive on the perception of the compact Ghanasanya have the habit of grasping everything. The ordinary man of the world, fully overcome by craving and grasping, entertains a perception of permanence, since he has no insight. That is why he regards the world as a unit, due to his perception of the compact. As he takes cognizance only of the arising aspect, ignoring the decaying aspect. Whether such a world is eternal or not, is the point at issue in the case of the first set of questions mentioned above. While the next set poses the dilemma whether it's infinite or finite. What is at the root of all those ill-conceived notions is the premise that it is possible to posit an absolute existence or an absolute non-existence. In other words, the two extreme views everything exists and nothing exists. The unique norm of dependent arising, which the Buddha discovered, dismisses both those extreme views. It is set forth in the Kacchayanagotta Sutta of the Nidana Samyukta in the Samyukta Nikaya, which we have quoted earlier too. We shall, however, bring up again the relevant section to elucidate this point. Dvaya nissiru kvayam kacchayana loko yebhuyena antitanchiva natantitanchi. Loka samudayam ko kanchayana yathabhutam sammapanyaya passato ya loke natantita sana hoti. Loka niroddham ko kanchayana yathabhutam sammapanyaya passato ya loke attita sana hoti. This word kacchayana for the most part bases its views on two things, on existence and non-existence. Now, kacchayana to one who, with right wisdom, sees the arising of the world as it is, the view of non-existence regarding the world does not occur. And to one who, with right wisdom, sees the cessation of the world as it really is, the view of existence regarding the world does not occur. Comment translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. This word, kacchayana, for the most part depends on a duality, upon the notion of existence and the notion of non-existence. But for one who sees the origin of the world as it really is with correct wisdom, there is no notion of non-existence in regard to the world. And for one who sees the cessation of the world as it really is with correct wisdom, there is no notion of existence in regard to the world. And here below I have given the Sanskrit and also the Chinese counterparts. End of comment. This is where our simile of the magic kettle becomes meaningful. Had both onlookers understood that the magic kettle is getting filled at the same time it gets emptied, and that the basin also gets filled while it is being emptied, they would not have the curiosity to go on looking at it. In contradistinction to both these viewpoints, the law of dependent arising promulgated by the Buddha transcends them by penetrating into the concept as such. The Buddha explained the rising of the world in terms of the 12 factors, beginning with dependent on ignorance preparations, precisely because it cannot be presented in one word. Usually the formula of dependent arising is summed up with the words ayam dukkha samudayam, this is the arising of suffering, or with the more conclusive statement evamitassa kevalassa dukkha kandassa samudayo hoti, thus is the rising of this entire mass of suffering. There are also instances of explaining the rising of the world to the principle underlying the norm of dependent arising. The world arises in the six sense bases. It is at the same time the arising of suffering. The arising of suffering is almost synonymous with the rising of the world. The law of dependent arising is an explanation of the way a concept of the world comes about. This is an extremely subtle point. Since the concept of the world is a product of wrong reflection, it is sankata, or prepared. It is like something imagined. The sankata, or the prepared, has a certain circularity about it. In fact, the two dilemmas mentioned above involve the question of time and space. The question whether the world is eternal or not eternal concerns time, whereas the question whether the world is finite or infinite relates to space. Both time and space involve a circularity. The furthest limit of the forenoon is the nearest limit of the afternoon, and the furthest limit of the afternoon is the nearest limit of the forenoon. This is how the cycle of the day turns round. Where the forenoon ends is the afternoon, where the afternoon ends is the forenoon. A similar time cycle is to be found even in one moment. Rise and fall occur as a cycle, even within a single moment. The same process goes on within an aeon. That is why an aeon is said to have the two aspects called samvatta, compaction, and vivatta, expansion. World systems go on contracting and expanding. The so-called existence of the world is a continuous process of contraction and expansion. Therefore, it is impossible to find any beginning or end. The very question of a first beginning is ill-conceived. It is like an attempt to find a starting point in a cycle. It is a problem that cannot be solved by speculation. Because of the cyclic nature of existence, rise and fall is characteristic of every single moment. It is by ignoring the decaying aspect inherent in one moment that wrong reflection gives rise to the inference that there must be an absolute end of the world. Because the visible world gets destroyed, one conceives of an absolute end of the world. But when one world system gets destroyed, another world system gets crystallized somewhere else. Speculative views and standpoints about the universe, current among the worldlings, are of such a misleading nature that any reasoning based on them leads to a circularity of argument, as is evident from the Lokayatika Brahmana Sutta among the nines of the Anguttara Nikaya. This discourse is about two Lokayatika Brahmins. The term Lokayatika is a derivative from Lokayata, which signifies a branch of knowledge dealing with the length and breadth of the world, perhaps a prototype of modern science, though it relied more on logic than on experiment. The two Brahmins were probably students of such a branch of learning. One day they came to the Buddha and posed this question, "Sire Gautama, now here's this teacher Purana Kassapa who claims omniscience, saying that he sees everything and has knowledge and vision of everything while walking or standing, whether asleep or awake. With these claims to omniscience, he makes the following declaration. Aham anantena jnanin anantam lokam jnanam pasam viharami. I dwell knowing and seeing an infinite world with an infinite knowledge. But then there is this teacher Nigantanatha Buddha, who also has similar claims to omniscience, but declares, Aham antavantena jnanin antavantam lokam jnanam pasam viharami. I dwell knowing and seeing a finite world with a finite knowledge. Comment, translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. Master Gotama, Purana Kassapa claims to be all-knowing and all-seeing, and to have all-embracing knowledge and vision. Whether I am walking, standing, sleeping, or awake, knowledge and vision are constantly and continuously present to me. He says thus, with infinite knowledge, I dwell knowing and seeing the world to be infinite. But Nigantanatha Buddha also claims to be all-knowing and all-seeing, and to have all-embracing knowledge and vision. Whether I am walking, standing, sleeping, and awake, knowledge and vision are constantly and continuously present to me. He says thus, with infinite knowledge, I dwell knowing and seeing the world to be finite. There must be a mistake here. It should be finite knowledge. With finite knowledge, I dwell knowing and seeing the world to be finite. End of comment. And then the two Brahmins ask the Buddha which of these two teachers claiming omniscience in such contradictory terms is correct. But the Buddha's reply was, Alang Brahmana Titta Detam Dhammam Vodisisami. Enough Brahmins, let that question be. I shall preach to you the Dhamma. The expression used here is suggestive of the fact that the question belongs to the category of unexplained points. Terms like tapita, left aside, and tapaniya, should be left aside, are used with reference to indeterminate points. Why did the Buddha leave the question aside? We can guess the reason, though it is not stated as such. Now the standpoint of Purana Kassava is, I dwell knowing and seeing an infinite world with an infinite knowledge. One can question the validity of his claim with the objection, you see an infinite world because your knowledge is not finite, that is to say, incomplete. If it is complete, there must be an end. Therefore, going by the sense of incompleteness in the word Ananta, one can refute the former view. Why you see the world as infinite is because your knowledge lacks finality. Nigantanatha Putta, on the other hand, is asserting that he sees a finite world with a finite knowledge. But the followers of Purana Kassapa can raise the objection, you are seeing the world as finite because your knowledge is limited. Your knowledge has an end, that is why you see a finite world. So here too we have a circle, or rather a circularity of argument. The two terms anta and ananta are ambiguous. That must be the reason why the Buddha rejected the two standpoints in question. And then he declares, I shall preach to you the Dhamma, and brings up, as a simile, an illustration which could be summed up as follows. Four persons endowed with the highest ability to walk, the highest speed and the widest stride possible, stand in the four directions. Their speed is that of an arrow, and their stride is as wide as the distance between the Eastern Ocean and the Western Ocean. Each of them tells himself, I will reach the end of the world by walking, and goes on walking for 100 years, that being his full lifespan. Resting just for eating, drinking, defecating, urinating, and giving way to sleep or fatigue, only to die on the way without reaching the end of the world. But why so? Asked the Buddha rhetorically, and gives the following explanation. I do not say, O Brahmins, that the end of the world can be known, seen, or reached by this sort of running. Nor do I say that there is an ending of suffering without reaching the end of the world. Then he declares, Brahmins, it is these five spans of sense pleasures that in the Noble One's discipline are called the world. Comment, translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. I say, Brahmins, that by this kind of running, one cannot know, see, or reach the end of the world. And yet I say that without having reached the end of the world, there is no making an end of suffering. These five objects of sensual pleasure, Brahmins, are called the world in the Noble One's discipline. End of comment. In this particular context, the Buddha calls these five kinds of sense pleasures the world, according to the Noble One's terminology. This does not contradict the earlier definition of the world in terms of the six sense bases, for it is by means of these six sense bases that one enjoys the five strands of sense pleasures. However, as an art of preaching, the Buddha defines the world in terms of the five strands of sense pleasures in this context. Then he goes on to proclaim the way of transcending this world of the five sense pleasures in terms of jhanic attainments. When one attains to the first jhana, one is already far removed from that world of the five sense pleasures. But about him, the Buddha makes the following pronouncement. Ahampi brahmana evam vadami ayampi loka pariyapanno ayampi anissato lokam hati. And I too, O Brahman, say this, this one too is included in the world. This one too has not stepped out of the world. The Buddha makes the same pronouncement with regard to those who attain the other jhanic levels. But finally he comes to the last step with these words. Punachaparang brahmana bhikkhu sabbasu neva sanya na sanya yatanang samadikkama sanya vidayate niruddhang upasampanja viharati Panyaya chasa disva asava parikinkina honti. Ayam buddhinshati brahmana bhikkhu lokasya antanga gamno. Lokasya ante viharati tinno loke visatikam. But then, O Brahmin, the monk, having completely transcended the sphere of neither perception nor non-perception, attains to and abides in the cessation of perceptions and feelings. And in him, having seen with wisdom, the influxes are made extinct. This one, O Brahmins, is known as one who, on reaching the end of the world, is dwelling at its very end, having crossed over the agglutinative craving. Comment? Translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. Again, by completely surmounting the base of neither perception nor non-perception, a bhikkhu enters and dwells in the cessation of perception and feeling, and having seen with wisdom, his stains are utterly destroyed. This is called a bhikkhu who, having come to the end of the world, dwells at the end of the world, one who has crossed over attachment to the world. End of comment. Going by these discourses, one might conclude that the cessation of perception and feeling is actually Nibbana itself. But the most important part of the above quotation is the statement, Panyaya chasadisva asava parikinkina honti. Having seen with wisdom, the influxes are made extinct in him. While in the attainment of the cessation of perceptions and feelings, all preparations subside. And it is on rising from it that all influxes are made extinct by the vision of wisdom. This fact comes to light in the following answer of Venerable Dhammadinna Thiri to the question raised by the lay follower Visakha, her former husband, in the Chula Vidala Sutta. Sanya Vedayata Niroda Samapatiya Bhutnitanko Avoso Visakha Bhikkhung Tayo Passa Pusanti Sunyato Passo Animitanto Passo Appanito Passo. Friend Visakha, when a monk has emerged from the attainment of the cessation of perceptions and feelings, three kinds of contact touch him. Voidness contact, signless contact, desireless contact. Comment translation by Nyanamoli. When a bhikkhu has emerged from the attainment of the cessation of perception and feeling, three kinds of contact touch him. Voidness contact, signless contact, desireless contact. And here is the Madhyama Agama, which has a slightly different list of contacts. When a monk emerges from the concentration of cessation, he contacts three types of contact. What are the three? 1. Imperturbable contact. 2. Nothingness contact. 3. Signless contact. End of comment. On this point, the commentary too gives the explanation sunyata nama phala samapatti. Voidness means the attainment of the fruit of arahanthood. In answer to another question, Venerable Dhammadinna Thiri says, sanya vidayata nirva samapattiya buddhitassa kuavusa visaka bhikkhuno viveka ninnang chittam hoti viveka punang viveka pabbaram. Friend Visakha, when a monk has emerged from the attainment of the cessation of perceptions and feelings, his mind inclines to seclusion, slants to seclusion, tends to seclusion. Comment, just the Madhyama Agama parallel. When a monk has emerged from the concentration of cessation, his mind delights in seclusion, it tends towards seclusion, it inclines towards seclusion. End of comment. Here the commentary explains Nibbanam Vivekonama, what is called seclusion is Nibbana. So it is on emerging from the attainment of the cessation of perceptions and feelings, that is in the Arhatapala Samadhi, references to which we have cited earlier, that Nibbana is realized. It is then that one actually sees the end of the world. Comment, yeah, I am not entirely sure I understand the Venerable here quite correctly, and so I just wanted to present my understanding. There is in general a point that I am not sure I would go along with all the instances where the Venerable identifies certain passages as referring only to Arhatapala Samadhi or Samapatti, anyway, an expression only found in the commentaries, that all of these would be experiences of the fruition by arahants. I do think they could also refer to lower levels of awakening. And I think this is particularly relevant to the question of cessation of perception and feelings. Well, I'm not sure about his formulation here, but it could be read to mean that this attainment of cessation, one who emerges from that will thereby automatically become an arahant. I'm not sure if that is really the sense he wants to convey here, but I thought at least to clarify for those to whom this might give this impression. And there's a discourse in the Anguttara Nikaya. Whenever Sariputta makes a particular statement and is being contradicted again and again by another monk. And eventually the Buddha makes the same statement, and they were saying this is right what Whenever Sariputta said. And here is the statement by the Buddha. Ida bhikkave bhikkhu sila sampanno samadhi sampanno paññā sampanno saññā vidāyate nirodhaṃ sammāpajjayāpi buddhayāpi atitaṃ thāna no cittiteva dhamme anyaṃ āraddheya atikammeva kabalinkārāre bhakkānaṃ divānaṃ sabhyataṃ anyataraṃ manamayaṃ kāyaṃ upapanno saññā vidāyate nirodhaṃ sammāpajjayāpi buddhayāpi atitaṃ thāna. And here the translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi, just a statement by the Buddha. Here, because a bhikkhu accomplished in virtuous behavior, concentration and wisdom might enter and emerge from the cessation of perception and feeling. If he does not reach final knowledge in this very life, then having been reborn among a certain group of mind-made deities that transcend the company of devas that subsist on edible food, he might again enter and emerge from the cessation of perception and feeling. There is this possibility. So I think this passage makes it indubitably clear that someone who attains cessation of perception and feeling is not necessarily an arahant on emerging from it. And I think this is also a helpful perspective if we want to put together the two descriptions of Venerable Sariputta in the Dīghanaka Sutta and the Anupāda Sutta of the Majjhima Nikāya. Good, it is possible to simply take the position that the Dīghanaka is the original version of Sariputta's attainment of arahantship. We have Samyukta Agama parallels to that. Anupāda Sutta is a little unusual and has no parallels, but it could still be interpreted as describing only his attainment of non-return in this whole list of concentrative experiences he makes, and that then his breakthrough to arahantship happened actually while in the Dīghanaka Sutta, while he was attending on the Buddha, and the Buddha was actually giving instructions to the wanderer Dīghanaka. I'm not necessarily wanting to take a stance on one or the other interpretation. I'm just saying that this possibility that somebody can be an attainer of the cessation of perception feeling, but still only be a non-returner, and not necessarily an arahant. And there's also this passage from the Visuddhimagga. I just want to bring in the commentarial explanation on the emergence from cessation. Katam uttananti anagamisa anagami palupattiya arato arapalupattiya evam dveda uttanam hoti. Nyanamuli's translation, how does emergence from it come about? The emergence comes about in two ways, thus by means of the fruition of non-return in the case of the non-return, or by means of the fruition of arahantship in the case of the arahant. We have a very detailed study of cessation in different Buddhist traditions by Griffith, and he comments to take Buddha Ghosa's mention of the occurrence of the fruits as descriptive of the first mental events that occur upon leaving the attainment of a cessation. So the point seems to be, at least from the commentary perspective, that one who comes out of cessation will then re-experience the fruition of either non-return or arahantship already attained earlier. Good, yeah, I wanted to clarify that I'm not necessarily saying that the Venerable was intending something different. I'm just not quite clear. I read through it a few times and just wanted to avoid that the way he expresses the point leads to conclusions that are contrary to what the discourses indicate. That is all, and end of the comment now. So from this we can well infer that in advancing a new definition of the world, in introducing a new concept of the world, the Buddha was not trying to sidetrack the moot point of the worldlings by bringing in something totally irrelevant. He was simply rejecting, for some sound reason, the worldlings' concept of the world, which is born of wrong reflection, and illustrating the correct measuring rod. The true criterion of judgment regarding the origin of the concept of the world according to radical reflection. Out of all the discourses dealing with the question of the end of the world and the end of suffering, perhaps the most significant is the Rohitasa Sutta, which is found in the Saggataka Samyutta of the Samyutta Nikaya, as well as in the section of the fourth in the Anguttara Nikaya. Once when the Buddha was staying at the Jetavana monastery at Savatthi, a deity named Rohitasa visited him in the night and asked the following question. Where, Lord, one does not get born, nor grow old, nor die, nor pass away, nor get reborn, is one able, Lord, by travelling, to come to know that end of the world, or to see it, or to get there? And the Buddha replies, where, friend, one does not get born, nor grow old, nor die, nor pass away, nor get reborn, that end of the world, I say, one is not able by travelling to come to know, or to see, or to arrive at. Comment translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. Is it possible, Venerable Sir, by travelling to know, or to see, or to reach the end of the world, where one is not born, does not age, does not die, does not pass away, and is not reborn? As to that end of the world, friend, where one is not born, does not age, does not die, does not pass away, and is not reborn, I say that it cannot be known, seen, or reached by travelling. And here's the similar exchange in the Chinese Samyukta Agama. End of comment. When the Buddha gave this brief answer, the deity Rohitasa praised him with the following words of approbation. Ancharyam bhante abmodang bhante yava subhasyam idang bhagavata. It is wonderful, Lord, it is marvelous, Lord. How well it is said by the Exalted One. Why did he express his approbation? Because he had already realized the truth of the Buddha's statement by his own experience. Then he goes on to relate the whole story of his past life. In times past, Lord, I was a seer, Rohitasa by name, son of Bhoja, gifted so that I could fly through the air. And so swift, Lord, was my speed that I could fly just as quickly as a master of archery, well-trained, expert, proficient, a past master in his art, armed with a strong bow, could without difficulty send a light arrow far past the area colored by a palm tree's shadow. And so great, Lord, was my stride that I could step from the eastern to the western ocean. In me, Lord, arose such a wish as this, I will arrive at the end of the world by walking. And though such, Lord, was my speed and such my stride, and though with the lifespan of a century, living 400 years, I walk continuously for 100 years, except for the time spent in eating, drinking, chewing, or tasting, or in answering calls of nature, and the time I gave to weigh, to sleep, or fatigue, yet I died on the way, without reaching the end of the world. Wonderful it is, O Lord, marvelous it is, Lord, how well it is said by the Exalted One, where, friend, one does not get born, nor grow old, nor die, nor pass away, nor get reborn, that end of the world, I say, one is not able by travelling to come to know, or to see, or to arrive at. Comment translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. It's wonderful, Venerable Sir, it is amazing, Venerable Sir, how well this was stated by the Blessed One. As to that end of the world, friend, I say, that it cannot be known, seen, or reached by travelling. Once in the past, Venerable Sir, I was a seer named Rohitasa, son of Bhoja, possessed of spiritual powers, able to travel through the sky. My speed was such, Venerable Sir, that I could move just as swiftly as a firm boat archer, trained, skillful, practice, experienced, could easily shoot past the shadow of a palmyra tree with a light arrow. My strength was such, Venerable Sir, that it seemed to reach from the eastern ocean to the western ocean. Then, Venerable Sir, the wish arose in me, I will reach the end of the world by traveling. Possessing such speed and such a stride, having a lifespan of 100 years, living for 100 years, I traveled for 100 years without pausing except to eat, drink, take meals and snacks, and to defecate and urinate, to sleep and dispel fatigue. Yet I died along the way without having reached the end of the world. And here's a similar passage from the Chinese. End of comment. It is at this point that the Buddha comes out with a momentous declaration while granting Rohatasa's approbation. Yanda guavu sana jayati na jiyati na miyati na chalati na upapanjati. Nang tang gamanena lokasantang nyateyam datteyam patteyam divadami. Nachahang avusu apatva lokasantang dukkha santakiriyam vadami. Apichahang avusu imasmin yeva vyama matde kalevare sasanyam hi samanake. Lokancha panyapimi lokasamudayancha lokanirodancha lokanirodagamininche patipadam. Dear friend, one does not get born nor grow old, nor die nor pass away nor get reborn. That end of the world, I say, one is not able by travelling to come to know or to see or to arrive at. But neither do I say, friend, that without having reached the end of the world, there could be an ending of suffering. It is in this very fathom-long physical frame with its perceptions and mind that I declare lies the world, the arising of the world, the cessation of the world, and the path leading to the cessation of the world. Comment. Translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. As to that end of the world, friend, where one is not born, does not age, does not die, does not pass away, and is not reborn, I say that it cannot be known, seen, or reached by travelling. However, friend, I say that without having reached the end of the world, there is no making an end to suffering. It is, friend, in just this fathom-high carcass, endowed with perception and mind, that I make known the world, the origin of the world, the cessation of the world, and the way leading to the cessation of the world. And here again the Chinese, and it additionally also speaks of the path leading to the cessation of the world, which is the Noble Eightfold Path. End of comment. This momentous declaration, which is comparable to a fearless lion's roar that puts our religious and philosophical systems to flight, has been misinterpreted by some who have not grasped its true significance. They say that according to this discourse, the cessation of the world is not here, and that only the other three are to be found in this fathom-long body. Such misinterpretations are the result of taking seriously various far-fetched speculations of later origin about Nibbana. According to them, Nibbana is some mysterious, nondescript place of rest for the arahants after their demise. One who goes by that kind of speculation is not ready to accept the Buddha's declaration that it is in this very fathom-long body, with this perception and mind, that the cessation of the world can be realized. The commentary in this context simply observes that the Four Noble Truths are to be found not in grass and twigs outside, but in this body consisting of the four elements. It has nothing more to add. A certain modern scholar has rightly pointed out that the commentator has missed a great opportunity for exegesis. The reason for the commentator's lack of interest in the case of such a discourse of paramount importance is probably his predilection for these later speculations on Nibbana. All that we have so far stated in explaining the significance of discourses dealing with the subject of Nibbana could even be treated as a fitting commentary to the Rohitasa Sutta. The point of relevance is the couple of words sasanyam hi samanake occurring in the discourse in question. The fathom-long frame, physical frame, is here associated with perceptions and mind. comment. Yeah, I found this very helpful, because there's also another tendency to misinterpretation, or misinterpretation is a slightly strong term, but to give undue emphasis to this reference to the body, as if everything now has to be in some form a somatic kind of experience. And I think the whole concern we have nowadays with embodiment is very good and very important. And the embodied forms of meditation practice are indeed central in early Buddhism. But this saying, this pointing to this body, is not so much a question of pointing to the physical body as such, but more saying it's here and not somewhere out there. And I'm very glad that Venerable Jnanananda brings it up, that this comes precisely when one keeps on reading that passage, sasanyam hi samanake, with perception in mind. That makes it clear that this is not just a question of the body, but it's simply taking the body as saying it's in here and not somewhere out there. End of comment. The expression used by the Buddha in this context is full of significance. As we saw above, Venerable Ananda defines the world as follows. Yena ko avuso lokasmin lokasani hoti lokamani ayam bocchiti ariyasa vinaya loko. Friend, that by which one has a perception of the world and has a conceit of the world, that in the discipline of the noble ones is called the world. The conceit of the world is the form of measuring with the mind. So the two words sasanyam hi samanake are suggestive of the concept of the world in the noble one's discipline. While discussing the significance of Arahata Palasamapati, also known as Anya Palasamadhi and Anya Vimukha, we had occasion to bring up such quotations as the following. Siyanuko bhande vikuno tatarupo samadhi pati labo yata neva pataving patavi sannyasa na pasming apo sannyasa na techasming techo sannyasa na vayasming vayo sannyasa na akasanancha yatane sannyasa na vinyanancha yatane vinyanancha yatane sannyasa na akinchanya yatane akinchanya yatane sannyasa na neva sanya na sanya yatan neva sanya na sanya yatan sanyas na ida loke sanyas na para loke sanyas yam pidang ditang sutang mutang binya tang patang pariyesi tang mana vichari tang manasa tatrapi na sanyas sanyi chapanas. Could there be a lord or a monk such an attainment of concentration wherein he will not be conscious, literally percipient, of earth in earth, nor of water in water, nor fire in fire, nor of air in air, nor will he be conscious of the sphere of infinite space in the sphere of infinite space, nor of the sphere of infinite consciousness in the sphere of infinite consciousness, nor of the sphere of nothingness in the sphere of nothingness, nor of the sphere of neither perception nor non-perception in the sphere of neither perception nor non-perception, nor will he be conscious of this world in this world, nor of a world beyond in a world beyond. Whatever is seen, heard, sensed, cognized, attained, sought after, traversed by the mind, even of that he will not be conscious, and yet he will be conscious. Translation by Mikambodhi. Bhante, could a bhikkhu obtain such a state of concentration that he would not be percipient of earth in relation to earth, of water in relation to water, of fire in relation to fire, of air in relation to air, of the base of the infinity of space in relation to the base of the infinity of space, of the base of the infinity of consciousness in relation to the base of the infinity of consciousness, of the base of nothingness in relation to the base of nothingness, of the base of neither perception nor non-perception in relation to the base of neither perception nor non-perception, of this world in relation to this world, of the other world in relation to the other world, of anything seen, heard, sensed, cognized, reached, sought after, and examined by the mind, but he would still be percipient. End of comment. The Arahata Palasamadhi is so extraordinary that while in it one has no perception of earth, water, fire and air, or of this world, or of the other world, of whatever is seen, heard, sensed and cognized, but one is all the same percipient or conscious, sannyi-japanasa. To the question of what is he percipient, King Sanyi, once Venerable Sariputta gave the answer that the perception is of Nibbana as the cessation of existence, bhava-nirodho-nibbanam. In another discourse that we happen to quote, the mode of questioning has the following sequence. Could there be, Lord, for a monk such an attainment of concentration wherein he will not be attending to the eye, nor to form, nor to ear, nor to sound, etc., but ends with the riddle-like phrase, and yet he will be attending? Manasichapanakareya. When the Buddha grants the possibility of such a concentration, Venerananda rejoins with an inquisitive, how could there be, Lord? And the Buddha explains that what a monk attends to while in that attainment could be summed up in the stereotype phrase, etang santang etang panitang, yadidang sabasankara samato, sabbo paripatinisango, tanakkayo virago nirodho nippanam. This is peaceful, this is excellent. Namely, the stilling of all preparations, the relinquishment of all assets, and the destruction of craving, detachment, cessation, extinction. Comment translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. This is peaceful, this is sublime, that is, the stilling of all activities, the relinquishment of all acquisitions, the destruction of craving, dispassion, cessation, nibbana. End of comment. It is nibbana, then, that one attends to while in that attainment. So we find even the terms perception, sannya, and attention, manasikara, being used in the context of arahata palasamapati, or attainment to the fruit of arahant. Therefore, nibbana is not an experience as dry as a log of wood, but a state of serene awareness of its true significance. It is a transcendence of the world by realization of its cessation. That is why the two words sasanyam hi samanake, with its perceptions and mind, have been used to qualify kalivare, physical frame or body, in the momentous declaration. We also come across some instances in the discourses where the Buddha calls the cessation of the six senses itself nibbana. The most notable instance is perhaps the Kamaguna Sutta we had already quoted. As we saw, even its presentation is rather enigmatic. It runs, Tasmati abhikave se ayatane viditambe yatanta chakkuncha nirunjati rupa sanyacha viranjati se ayatane viditambe yatasotancha nirunjati sadda sanyacha viranjati se ayatane viditambe yataghanancha nirunjati gandha sanyacha viranjati se ayatane viditambe yatajivacha nirunjati rasa sanyacha viranjati se ayatane viditambe yatakayacha nirunjati pottabba sanyacha viranjati se ayatane viditambe yatammanucha nirunjati dhamma sanyacha viranjati se ayatane viditambe. Therefore, monks, that sphere should be known when the eye ceases and the perception of forms fades away. The ear ceases and the perception of sounds fades away. The nose ceases and the perception of smells fades away. The tongue ceases and the perception of tastes fade away. The body ceases and the perception of tangibles fades away. The mind ceases and the perception of ideas fades away. That sphere should be known. Comment, translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. Therefore, because that base should be known where the eye ceases and perceptions of form fades away. That base should be known where the ear ceases and perception of sounds fades away. That base should be understood where the mind ceases and perception of mental phenomena fades away. That base should be understood. And here's the Chinese making basically the same statement. End of comment. Venerable Ananda, commenting on this riddle-like sermon of the Buddha, concludes that the Buddha is here referring to the cessation of the six sense spheres. Salayatana nirodham navoso bhagavata sandhaya bhasitam. Friends, it is with reference to the cessation of the six sense spheres that the Exalted One has preached this sermon. Comment, Bhikkhu Bodhi. Translation, this was stated by the Blessed One, friends, with reference to the cessation of the six sense bases. And the Chinese relevant corresponding statement in the Samyukta Agama. End of comment. The cessation of the six sense spheres is Nibbana. All this goes to show that the concept of a world is the product of the six sense spheres. Those six measuring rods have measured out a world for us. Since the world is built up by the six sense spheres, it also has to cease by the cessation of those six sense spheres. That is why Nibbana is defined as the cessation of the six sense spheres. Salayatana nirodho nibbana. all those measuring rods and scales lose their applicability with the cessation of the six sense spheres. How can there be an experience of cessation of the six sense spheres? The cessation here meant is actually the cessation of the spheres of contact. A sphere of contact presupposes a duality. Contact is always between two things, between eyes and phones, for instance. It is because of a contact between two things that one entertains a perception of permanence in those two things. Depending on that contact, feelings and perceptions arise, creating a visual world. The visual world of the humans differs from that of animals. Some things that are visible to animals are not visible to humans. That is due to the constitution of the eye faculty. It is the same with regard to the ear faculty. These are the measuring rods and scales which build up a world. Now this world, which is a product of the spheres of sense contact, is a world of papancha or proliferation. Nibbana is called Nipapancha because it transcends this proliferation, puts an end to proliferation. The end of proliferation is at the same time the end of the six sense spheres. There's a discourse in the section of the fours in the Anguttara Nikaya which clearly brings out this fact. There we find Venerable Mahakotita putting a question to Venerable Sariputta on this point. Venerable Mahakotita and Venerable Sariputta are often found discussing intricate points in the Dhamma. Not because they are in doubt, but in order to clarify matters for us. They are threshing out problems for our sake. In this particular instance, Venerable Mahakotita puts the following question to Venerable Sariputta. Channanga vusa pasayatana ananga sesa viraga niroda atanyan kinchi. Friend, with the remainderless fading away and cessation of the six fins, spheres of sense contact, is there something left? Venerable Sariputta's response was, Mahira Navuso, do not say so, friend. Venerable Mahakotita follows it up with three other possible alternatives, all of which Venerable Sariputta dismisses with the same curt reply. The three alternatives were Channang Navuso Pasayatananang Asesa Viraga Nirodho Natanyang Kinchi. Friend, with the remainderless fading away and cessation of the six spheres of sense contact, is there nothing left? Channanga avu sapasayatana ananga sisa viraga niroda aticha natichanyan kinchi. Friend, with the remainderless fading away and cessation of the six spheres of sense contact, is it the case that there is and is not something left? Channanga avu sapasayatana ananga sisa viraga niroda nivati nonatatnyan kinchi. Friend, with the remainderless fading away and cessation of the six spheres of contact, is it the case that there neither is nor is not something left? Comment, translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. Friend, with the remainderless fading away and cessation of the six bases for contact, is there anything else? Do not say so, friend. With the remainderless fading away and cessation of the six bases for contact, is there nothing else? Do not say so, friend. With the remainderless fading away and cessation of the six bases for contact, is there both something else and nothing else? Do not say so, friend. With the remainderless fading away and cessation of the six bases for contact, is there neither something else nor nothing else? Do not say so, friend. And here is the Samyukta Agama. The Venerable Ananda asked the Venerable Sariputta, when the six spheres of contact have been eradicated, faded away, ceased, appeased, and disappeared, is there something that still remains? The Venerable Sariputta said to Ananda, you should not ask this question. When the six sense spheres of contact have been eradicated, faded away, ceased, appeased, and disappeared, is there something that still remains? Ananda asked the Venerable Sariputta again, when the six spheres of contact have been eradicated, faded away, ceased, appeased, and disappeared, is there nothing that still remains? The Venerable Sariputta said to Ananda, it is also not proper to ask in this way. When the six spheres of contact have been eradicated, faded away, ceased, appeased, and disappeared, is there nothing that still remains? Ananda asked the Venerable Sariputta again, when the six spheres of contact have been eradicated, faded away, ceased, appeased, and disappeared, is there something that remains and nothing that remains, or neither something that remains nor nothing that remains? The Venerable Sariputta said to Ananda, it is also not proper to ask in this way. When the six spheres of contact have been eradicated, faded away, ceased, appeased, and disappeared, is there something that remains and nothing that remains, or neither something that remains nor nothing that remains? So we can see that the basic point of the exchange is quite similar, even though there is a difference in personality, as here the discussion is with Venerable Ananda and not with Venerable Mahakotita. Such exchange of the identity of the speaker in some of these dialogues is quite a normal occurrence in oral transmission. End of quote. This mode of questioning takes the form of a tetralemma, and Venerable Sariputta dismisses all the four alternatives as inapplicable. Then Venerable Mahakotita asks why all these four questions were ruled out, and Venerable Sariputta explains. Channang avu sapasayatananang asesa viruaga niroda atanyang kinchiti iti varang apapanchang papanchiti. Channang avu sapasayatananang asesa viruaga niroda natanyang kinchiti iti varang apapanchang papanchiti. Channang avu sapasayatananang asesa viruaga niroda atti chan natti chanyang kinchiti iti varang apapanchang papanchiti. Channang avu sapasayatananang asesa viraga niruddha nevatti no nattanyam kinchiti iti vadang apapancham papanchiti. Yavata avu suchannang pasayatananang gati tavata papanchasya gati. Yavata papanchasya gati tavata channang pasayatananang gati. Channang avu sapasayatananang asesa viraga niruddha papancha niruddho papancha upasamo. Friend, he who says with the remainderless fading away and cessation of the six sense spheres of sense contact, there is something left is conceptually proliferating what should not be proliferated conceptually. Friend, he who says with the remainderless fading away and cessation of the six spheres of sense contact, there is nothing left is conceptually proliferating what should not be proliferated conceptually. Friend, he who says with the remainderless fading away and cessation of the six spheres of sense contact, there is and is not something left is conceptually proliferating what should not be proliferated conceptually. Friend, he who says with the remainderless fading away and cessation of the six spheres of sense contact, there neither is nor is not something left is conceptually proliferating what should not be proliferated conceptually. Friend, whatever is the range of the six spheres of sense contact, that itself is the range of conceptual proliferation. And whatever is the range of conceptual proliferation, that itself is the range of the six spheres of sense contact. By the remainderless fading away and cessation of the six spheres of sense contact, there comes to be the cessation appeasement of conceptual proliferation. Comment translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. Friend, if one says with the remainderless fading away and cessation of the six bases for contact, there is something else, one proliferates that which is not to be proliferated. If one says, friend, with the remainderless fading away and cessation of the six bases for contact, there is nothing else. One proliferates that which is not to be proliferated. If one says, friend, with the remainderless fading away and cessation of the six bases for contact, there is both something else and nothing else. One proliferates that which is not to be proliferated. If one says, friend, with the remainderless fading away and cessation of the six bases for contact, there is neither something else nor nothing else. One proliferates that which is not to be proliferated. Friend, as far as the range of the six bases for contact extends, just so far extends the range of proliferation. As far as the range of proliferation extends, just so far extends the range of the six bases for contact. With the remainderless fading away and cessation of the six bases for contact, there is the cessation of proliferation, the subsiding of proliferation. And here the Samyukta Agga. Parallel. The Venerable Sariputta said to the Venerable Ananda, this is indeed baseless talk. When the six spheres of contact have been eradicated, faded away, ceased, appeased, and disappeared, is there something that remains? This is indeed baseless talk. Is there nothing that remains? This is indeed baseless talk. Is there something that remains and nothing that remains? This is indeed baseless talk. Is there neither something that remains nor nothing that remains? If one says, when the six spheres of contact have been eradicated, faded away, ceased, appeased, and disappeared, one attains nirvana and is apart from all that is baseless and false, then this is indeed what the Buddha taught. End of quote. The commentator gives the following explanation to the expression attanyam kinchi, is there something left? Tata param kochi appamatta kopi kilesa attiti pucchati. According to him, Venerama, Kotita is asking whether there is even a little defilement left after the cessation of the six spheres of sense contact. But the question is obviously not about the remaining defilements, in which case even a categorical negative could have been the correct answer. The question here is about the very usage of the expression is and is not. With the cessation of the six spheres of sense contact, all four propositions of the tetralemma, based on the two standpoints is and is not, lose their applicability. They are rejected in toto. Here the papancha or conceptual proliferation implied is the very discrimination between is and is not. The entire world is based, built up on the two concepts is and is not. Being unaware of the sankata or prepared nature of these concepts, we are accustomed to say this is, as occasion demands. This recording machine before us is there. So also are the things which we presume to exist. We ourselves do exist, do we not? One could say, I am. Out of the two rapid processes going on within us every moment, namely arising and passing away, we are most of the time dwelling on the side of arising. The two concepts is and is not are structured on the six spheres of sense contact. Not only is and is not, but also the entire logical structure connecting these two postulates is founded on the six spheres. Here then we see the fistfuls of inflammable incense powder the Buddha had directed towards language and logic, setting all that ablaze. What this discourse highlights is the fact that by the very cessation of the six spheres of sense contact, the cessation of conceptual proliferation is brought about. With reference to speculative views, particularly those wrong views that were put aside as unexplained points, the Buddha uses the term dittiparilaha, delirium of views. Parilaha means delirious fever. Patients in delirium cry out for water. The worldlings in general are in high delirium. Even such teachers like Purana, Purana Kassapa and Nigantanatha Buddha, who were trying to solve these speculative problems about the world by logic, were also in a delirium. Their views, based on wrong reflections, were mere hallucinations. They kept on raising such questions because they had no insight into the nature of sankharas or preparations. The worldlings spent their whole lifetime running in search of the world's end. All that is papancha, conceptual proliferation. In fact, the term papancha is so pervasive in its gamut of meaning that it encompasses the entire world. Usually, the term is glossed over by explaining it with reference to tanha, mana, and ditti, bringing in craving, conceit, and views as illustrations of papancha. But that does not amount to an explanation proper. It is only a definition and extension by giving three instances of papancha. To rattle off the three instances is not a fit answer to the question, what is papancha? The primary significance of papancha is traceable to the linguistic medium. We have already shown how the network of grammar spreads as soon as the peg M is driven down to earth, as it were. The reality in the first person in grammar beckons the second and the third person to complete the picture. In logic too, a similar ledger domain takes place. The indeterminate questions of identity and difference lead the logician up the garden path. The world is precariously perched on a fictitious network of grammar and logic. It is as a solution to all this that the Buddha came out with the extraordinary prospect of a cessation of the six spheres of sense contact. This then is the level of experience realizable here and now. That is why the Buddha declared that the world is in this very fathom-long body with its perceptions and mind. Now as to the questions about the world, we have already pointed out that there is a circularity involved. Though one cannot find an end in something of a cyclic nature, there is still the solution possible. There is only one solution, that is to break the cycle. That is what the term vattupacheda means. One can breach the cycle. The cycle cannot be discovered by traveling. It is not out there, but in this very stream of consciousness within us. We have already described it as the vortex between consciousness and name and form. An allusion to the breach of the vortex is found in the following verse, which we have already discussed in connection with Nibbana. Vijnanam anidassanam anantam sabbatopavam etta apuchapatavi techo vayana gadati etta digancha rasancha anuntulam subhasubam etta namancha rupancha asesam upurunjati vijnanasya nirodena ettetam upurunjati. Consciousness, which is non-manifestative, endless, lustrous on all sides, here it is that earth and water, fire and air, no footing find. Here it is that long and short, fine and coarse, pleasant, unpleasant, and name and form are cut off without exception. When consciousness has so ceased, these are held in check herein. Comment translation by Walsh. Where consciousness is signless, boundless, all luminous, that's where earth, water, fire and air find no footing. They are both long and short, small and great, fair and foul. Their name and form are wholly destroyed. With the cessation of consciousness, this is all destroyed. Here the Sanskrit, the Chinese, and the translation by Mysik of the Chinese, and I will not repeat all the discussion we had on this passage earlier. This must be answered. Consciousness, shapeless, extraordinary, radiating by its own, if this vanishes, then the four elements vanish. And coarse and subtle, nice and ugly vanish. Into this, name and form vanish too. If consciousness vanish, the rest vanishes too. End of quote. You won't then see how name and form are cut off. Jnanangani dasanang anantang sabatopabang. Consciousness which is non-manifestative, infinite, and lustrous on all sides. In this consciousness, even the four great primaries, earth, water, fire, and air, do not find a footing. Chakravala or world system is supposed to be made up of these four primary elements. Even the term Chakravala implies something cyclic. The world is a product of these primary elements, but these are not there in that non-manifestative consciousness. Such relative distinctions as long and short, subtle and gross, have no place in it. Name and form cease here, leaving no residue. Like an expert physician who treats the germ of a disease and immunizes the patient, the Buddha effected a breach in the samsaric vortex by concentrating on his epicycle within this fathom-long body. The ever-recurrent process of mutual interrelation between consciousness and name and form, forming the epicycle of the samsaric vortex, was breached. With the cessation of consciousness comes the cessation of name and form. With the cessation of name and form comes the cessation of consciousness. That is the dictum of the Nalaka Lapi Sutta. Out of the two bundles of weeds left standing, supporting each other, when one is thrown, the other falls down. Even so, with the cessation of consciousness comes the cessation of name and form. With the cessation of name and form comes the cessation of consciousness. That is how the Buddha solved this problem. Thank you for your attention.